Hello, I'm Dan.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Brad.
And we are the Men Who Explain Miracles. Hello and welcome back to the Men Who Explain Miracles, a podcast about impossible crime fiction. Last week, you guys had a great in-depth chat about the impossible crimes of Agatha Christie, and it was more of an overview of all the different novels and what they were about. This week, we're going to have a little bit more of a personal angle. We're going to look at the kind of legacy of Christie in our reading, what drew us to her writing, and what sort of lasts in our mind as Agatha Christie and Golden Age detection readers.
I'm really grateful that we are going to maybe step aside from the traditional locked room focus of your podcast and talk about my favorite author. So I'm going to start by asking a question. What brought you to Agatha Christie, and how did she sort of settle in as one of your major mystery reading choices?
I don't know if it's the same for both of you, but for many people, that's the first Golden Age detective stuff I ever read. I didn't know anything about her, and I just saw a book on a shelf at my in-law's house, and it was the 13 Problems. I didn't know what the book even was, how it was structured. I just assumed it was a number of random short stories. I didn't know they were all linked. So I started picking short stories from 13 Problems here, there and everywhere. And I came across The Ingots of Gold and then The Idle House of Astarte. I didn't realise you could do this with fiction. And that I really birthed a love for the whole genre.
I started reading her because I think early in 2000 or in 2001, there was some poll held that ended up voting her as the most significant mystery writer of the 20th century. And so a publisher, or a magazine publisher, started producing every 2 weeks. They would do a copy of a book and then a magazine about the writing of that book. And you could order them to be delivered to you by post. So you could go to the newsagents and buy them, or you could just set up a direct debit and they would send you two every month. And I was aware of Christie because I remember the David Suchet Poirot. I have these very vague memories of the Geraldine McEwan Marple as well. Never really settled in to watch any of it, but I just remember hearing the name Agatha Christie, Agatha Christie, Agatha Christie. And so I was just like, well, I've never read anything by her. I was quite into modern crime fiction at the time. I was reading a lot of, at the time, contemporary authors. And I just thought it would be interesting to see what these were like. So the first book was Murder on the Orient Express. I knew how that ended. I somehow knew the ending of it. So I bought that, really enjoyed it, and just signed up for the rest because it just seemed, if someone's just going to put two books through my door every month, that sounds ideal to me. And so I signed up really to, you know, 40 of these before I really had any sense of what the quality was like. I just decided to dive straight in with a book a month, or sorry, two books a month for 10, 15, 20 months, whatever it was. And yeah, the first few I didn't necessarily get to that quickly. I think it was The Murder at the Vicarage, I think, was second. And I didn't read that one for ages. And then I think it was The Big Four. And then I can't remember the exact order they came out. But then just gradually, the first one that really, really seized me was Peril at End House. And I remember being so blown away by the ending of Peril at End House, which a lot of people say, oh, it's hoary and it's tropey and it's really obvious what's going on. If you haven't read that kind of thing before, it's not hoary and it's not tropey. And I just remember being so blown away when I got to the end of that. And then after that, they just started to become a far more regular thing, and I just started to really tear through them.
What about you, Brad? What was your first Christie? As such a deep Christie fan, someone who writes about her continuously, I'm really interested to see how it all began for you.
I know nobody can tell from the sounds of our voices, but I'm significantly older than both of you.
Are you?
Yes. And when I started Christie, my family had just moved to another state. We had actually moved home to California after having lived in Arizona. I had read a lot of Hardy Boys and children's mysteries. I was an inveterate reader. I loved to read. Moving was traumatic. I wanted to move, but it became traumatic. We moved to this very strange community for a year. It was very unwelcoming. I had a lot of problems settling in. And I had had a babysitter in Arizona who would tell us these wonderful stories. And one of them was about 10 people on an island who were being killed off one by one.
Your babysitter.
Stephen Levy, if you are, through some miracle, listening to The Men Who Explain Miracles, I praise you on my blog every day. I thank you for introducing me through your story about birds attacking California to Alfred Hitchcock and the 10 people on the island. I was in a drugstore with my mom, and there was one of those carousels that had paperback books, and they had just brought out a new copy, tie-in with a Shirley Eaton, Hugh O'Brien version of 10 Little Indians. And it was red, and it had 10 Little Indians on it, and it said Agatha Christie. And I started looking at the back, and I was reading Steve's story. And I said, Mom, can I get this? My mother did not understand that it was a brutally graphic story of 10 people being slaughtered. She said, okay. So I got it.
So how old are you at this time?
11.
Wow.
And I took note that the carousel was filled with books with this woman's name on it. Went home, read it. I think a lot of people who have had And Then There Were None as their first are hooked right from the start.
Yeah, indeed.
Went out and bought my second, which was Murder on the Orient Express. In America, it was Murder in the Calais Coach. Mm. So you think you want to read classic mysteries, and the first mystery is where everybody dies. And the second mystery is another pretty intriguing variation on what you would expect of a closed circle mystery, without getting into spoilers. So I went out and I bought my next, I bought two, The Mousetrap and Other Stories, or Three Blind Mice and Other Stories, which is The Mousetrap in short story form, and a bunch of Poirot and Miss Marple and Parker Pine and Tommy and Tuppence and Harley Quinn stories, and A Caribbean Mystery, my first taste of Miss Marple. Again, completely different. And so amazing. I would sit in the living room downstairs while everyone was upstairs watching TV, and I would gasp. I just couldn't believe all this. And the next few years were kind of tough for me as a teenager, and I think in a way Agatha Christie did for me what she did for millions of British people between the wars. She brought me into this very interesting but safe circle where I could be totally absorbed in her stories. And she, I think, in some ways kind of saved me. And through her, she was my gateway drug. I bought John Dixon Carr, bought Ellery Queen. Those three were my childhood reading. And then I started branching out from there. But those three, for the longest time, were my top three. I would say now Christiana Brand probably supplanted Queen. But all these years later, and I'm, look at me, I'm like 28, 29 years old.
Yeah.
In spirit. And I still cherish them. And for whatever reason, and I don't know why, if maybe the movie started to come out or the audiobooks or whatever, but while I've read all these people, Christie's the one I come back to over and over and over again. And each time there's something new. It goes beyond plotting. It goes into the period. It goes into the characters. It goes into her, into her technique, into all of that. And she's the one I just embrace.
That's really fascinating, because having grown up with stories, I imagine you, actually both of you were big readers, I can imagine, when you were younger. But for me personally, what's amazing about hearing that is that I wasn't a reader at all. I didn't really read any books, didn't own really any books. My parents didn't own any books at all. So I only really started reading properly when I got into mystery books. You know, this is 7 or 8 years ago now. So I've kind of grown up as a grown-up with Christie and others. And it's amazing to hear how these books have influenced you right from the off, and you've loved those characters from the start. That's amazing.
I very nearly discovered Christie at about age 12, because my school library had the same thing, a spinny carousel with loads of her books on. And I remember going over and picking up Crooked House. And there's that introduction to Crooked House where she writes something like, people say when they read your books, oh, I had such fun reading this. It must have been such fun to write it. And often they say this about the books that were the most horrible ones to write. But I can actually say that having written this one, you know, having now written this one, this really has been incredibly enjoyable. There's that lovely, very chatty opening to it. And I have such a clear memory of picking this up. I could pick out the edition for you. I could show you the exact cover of this book. And I remember thinking, yeah, maybe I should read this. And then I don't know. I don't remember why. I just didn't. I put it back on the carousel and I went and picked up something probably awful. But it's fascinating to me to think I could have, whatever that would have been, you know, 8-9 years earlier, have maybe got into it so much sooner. Or maybe I wouldn't have been in the frame of mind for it. Maybe I would have read that. It would have been the wrong time. And I would have sworn off all classic mystery forever. And so, yeah, like you say, you went on to Queen and Carr and Brand and everything else. I did the same thing. I read the Christie. I've written about on my blog before, the Orion Crime Masterworks series, that because I thought maybe I could get more into this classic era stuff, see if any of it's good, that really was my gateway into then the more classic detective fiction. That's where I read my first Jim Thompson, that's where I read my first James M. Cain, that's where I read my first John Dixon Carr. And it's crazy, I go, I could have found Christie so much sooner and then I would have found those other books so much sooner, but maybe I wouldn't, maybe I would have found Christie sooner and sworn off her for life, yeah, and then missed that entirely.
And it's funny, isn't it, how people seem to, these days, tumble into Golden Age detective fiction. It's not likely that you're going to find maybe one Christie, but not like a lot of Christies and Queens and Cars in a top 10 books you must read before you die, or something like that, or to get you started off. Maybe you'll find Murder on the Orient Express, but it's probably going to be a lot of old white men, isn't it? And then, so it's interesting how people these days, I guess, who are becoming fans, are kind of tumbling into the...
Well, I don't know if you can imagine it, but you go walk into a bookstore and there would be shelf after shelf of what we now call Golden Age niche mystery fiction. I mean, I bought Carr because it was right next to Christie. Mm. I bought Queen because, well, they were very intriguing covers. And
yes.
There were these women sort of standing
holding massive pencils.
And, you know, it's like, what is this? The Signet covers. And the Carr covers are always good. But I know my first Carrs were Mad Hatter Mystery and Arabian Nights Mystery. And I remember reading your blog on Arabian Nights, and I just was so intrigued by the concept of Arabian Nights storytelling anyway, and the way this was told.
Yeah.
And Mad Hatter was a romp. That was just so much fun.
It's pretty fun.
But Christie got me started on all of that. And I had a beloved aunt, Aunt Rosalie, who would buy me a Christie for Christmas every year until stopped coming out. Well, that's what everyone talked about, is what's the Christie for Christmas? Mm. She was part of the conversation when you were talking about book buying. And so she gave me my Christie for Christmas. Now, my Christie for Christmas from her were Postern of Fate and
the last one,
Passenger to Frankfurt and Third Girl. So we had kind of lost the thrill, I guess. But I'll tell you, I embraced each one because I was mixing that up with the older ones, and I just assumed anyone I got, I was going to love.
Sure.
And I would hold those books in my hands with the same fervor that I held the Harry Potter books at midnight sales a few years ago. Yeah. That joy. Watching little kids buy the Harry Potter books reminded me of how I felt when a new Christie would come out. That's or if I found, story, yeah. If I went to a bookstore downtown and started finding the Fontana covers, the bee or the wasp with Death in the Clouds, which I had not even known existed, and then found these beautiful Tom Adams covers and started buying things. I think the last one I found, which I'd never heard of, was Taken at the Flood. Just uncovering like a, you know, a hidden treasure in an undiscovered Christie. So,
following on from that, then I suppose the question that occurs to me is, for both of you, what do you feel is your single happiest memory associated with reading Christie? I can tell you mine if that will help. I can start us off.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah,
I read Evil Under the Sun, a mystery novel about people on a sunny island on holiday getting murdered in a single day while on holiday on a Greek island.
Great.
And it was so beautiful. I remember I have this really distinct memory of just on this sun lounger in the sun, reading about people in the sun, just getting murdered. And it's such a great book, and it's such an entertaining book, and it's so swift. And I could have read that book at probably any other time, in any other setting, and I still would have really loved it. But there was something about it, just entirely by accident. I didn't know what the plot was when I picked it up. It didn't have it, these hardcovers that came through the post, they don't have the synopsis on the back. So I'd put the magazine somewhere and just grabbed the book, because I think by that point I was possibly reading her in order. That's from 1941, so I probably started doing her chronologically by then. But there's just something about that memory that just feels very quintessential about my relationship with Christie. I always think back to being on holiday, reading about this murderous holiday, just that joy of being in the sun reading about it.
One thing that springs to mind instantly for me is that, not really growing up as a reader and just beginning to find the joy of reading, to come to Hercule Poirot's Christmas. Now, that was one of the first Christies I ever read, because I'd heard, on looking on the internet for these things called locked room mysteries, because I'd realised that's what Jonathan Creek was, and now I was starting to connect the dots. And then a really beautiful cafe/secondhand bookshop that my wife used to work in called Husk, they just had a lot of books there, and I found the only Christie that was there, and it was Hercule Poirot's Christmas, and I'd heard that it was a locked room, and I thought, oh, I'll give this a try. And I remember just being, exactly as you said, absorbed so fast into it. And I'd never come across, a really strongly written solution to a locked room. And people have differing opinions about Hercule Poirot's Christmas. So I guess it'd be nice to hear yours. But seeing as I had never really read anything like that, the reveal of the killer was like mind-blowing.
Yes.
And then the locked room itself, I actually really liked. And because I hadn't really come across any other mechanisms, and there's a lovely bit of misdirection with some objects in the centre, which you'll probably both remember, which on looking back at it, I was like, gosh, so that relates to almost like magic. And then I could see like, oh, so sleight of hand and misdirection, this is how this genre works. And it was all just starting to click. And when I was reading it, meeting Lizzie off the train, I was coming to the solution, and I just had to get off the train early and stand in the platform and just read the last three chapters just straight through, because I had to know what was going to happen, because I suddenly saw maybe what was going to occur. And I thought, no, it can't be that. It's rare that actually, maybe as more experienced readers, that we get that level of young, early kind of explosive reading, unless you come across something so mind-blowing. But when you really have no idea of the genre, and you have no preconceptions, and you don't have I was going to say anything tainting your reading, but that's not what I mean. But anything contextualizing and shaping it, just rushing off the train to read the last three chapters of Hercule Poirot's Christmas, which is maybe not a sentence that everyone would say, was just a real joy for me.
I would sit downstairs and read. I remember getting to the end of Orient Express, and Poirot says, but they couldn't. I mean, I don't want to give it away, but, you know, he states the solution. And I went, oh, Mom,
Dad. With someone.
Nobody was there. They were up there, and they could care less. I wanted to tell somebody this. And that happened at the end of Greek Coffin Mystery, and that would happen, when I rarely got the right answer, and I would be like, oh my gosh, and there was nobody. So I shared a room with my brother. We did not get along. We fought all the time, and he had a friend named Jerry, and they were best friends. I guess you would call Jerry, for me, a prat. He was a jerk, you know. They were mean to me. They would laugh. They would, you know, whatever, about all kinds of things. So I saw him as kind of an enemy. And one day, he's in our room with my brother, and he looks up and he says, "Do you read Agatha Christie?" And I'm waiting for the axe to fall. And I said, "Yeah." He said, "I love Agatha Christie." And we started to talk about Agatha Christie. Well, he had more money than we do. He had more books than I did. He knew titles I did not know. And he told me about Stacy's Bookstore downtown, which had British editions and had titles I'd never heard of. So I took the streetcar down to Stacy's and found this gigantic glassy bookstore filled with mystery writers. That's when I started buying other writers too. But that's where I started finding these titles I hadn't heard of. And he had them all. And so I would read and he would read. And for the first time, and I have to tell you, until about 4 years ago, the last time in my life, I had someone for a little while who I could share this passion with. So we're not ending this blog until I can talk about some specific titles that I love. But that's probably that. And then the first time I found out that there were movies based on her books, that she was a phenomenon. Watching, unfortunately, Tony Randall in the ABC Murders, which is a god-awful movie, but I was so excited. I didn't quite understand why they'd done that to this movie, but to that book. And then, of course, the Margaret Rutherford films, which at least are amusing. Then in the 70s, when Murder on the Orient Express came out, and it was so... Sidney Lumet had so lovingly rendered it with such big stars... I thought, somebody has lavished a great deal of money and talent on this woman, and she deserves it. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad to know, to have discovered recently, that she did get to see it, because she was not happy with early films of her work, and she thought that one was pretty good. She didn't like the mustache on Poirot, but she liked the movie.
She wouldn't like the mustache on Branagh, though, would she? If she didn't
know.
Yeah, imagine that.
I would like to think that she would slap him. I there are a lot of people I would like to think she would slap. People who think they know her.
I had that sensation of desperately wanting to share the solution with someone, with and then there were none. I know that book is talked about so much, and I know it's almost a cliche to go on about how surprising and how devastating And Then There Were None is as a book. But I was reading it on a train. I was probably about, I think it was about a 2.5 hour train journey, and I just tore through the whole thing in under 2 hours, I think. Because I remember sitting there for half an hour. It feels like about half an hour in my memory. Just sitting there in the train, just staring at this book, like, did that really just happen?
did I just read that?
Really quite desperate to explain it to someone and to be able to give it to someone and get them to share in it and not go, you've got to read this book because this is the amazing ending. But that was the time when I really became, I think, really aware of trying to preserve that discovery for people and of not going, oh, this is incredible, but this is the thing that happens. Because prior to that, I had, as I said, Orient Express, someone had told me the ending. And there were various other novels, I think, that I was reading, not necessarily Christie novels, not even necessarily mystery novels, but you just somehow through societal awareness, like the ending had crept in. And Then There Were None was the first time I read a book and was just like, oh my, I need to talk about this with someone. And then I couldn't, because much like you, there wasn't anyone.
Yeah.
You know, you had Steve.
Who told me the ending.
Okay.
But I didn't know Steve anymore when I first read the book.
Yeah.
And knowing the ending did not matter.
No.
The way he told the story was different. The whole segment at the end with the police, I wasn't prepared for that. Mm. And the book is so beautifully rendered that you start to think maybe he was wrong.
Sure.
Yeah, nice.
Because, I mean... It didn't matter, but now if somebody tells me the ending, I ask Agatha Christie to slap them. I had the great good fortune to be at Bodies this weekend and to spend some time talking to different people, and I met the amazing John Curran. The first question he asked me was, what is your favorite Agatha Christie? Which he then rephrased for someone else because it's a terrible question. Mm-hmm. So
it is,
he rephrased it as, what is your desert island Agatha Christie? What's the one book you'd want to have on an island with you?
Nice.
We also talked about the idea of, is your favorite Christie the same as the best Christie? We realized that that's not always the case. That's 8 questions right there.
Yes. Yeah.
But I do love hearing people talk about what are the books that really epitomize the best of Christie for you? And there are so many of them. There's several of them. And I'm going to start with one, and I would love us to sort of share some of our favorites. You've talked a little bit about that. But one that I guess would be was my desert island Christie, even if it's not the best, is After the Funeral.
Mm.
1953 is when some people feel she was, as Laura Thompson, the biographer, said, working on autopilot. I closed the book for a little while when I read that. that these plots of the 50s, while sometimes charming, weren't quite original enough. There's something about that book from the start that just made me go, oh my gosh, this is mystery heaven. The first time I read it, we look first just at the mystery itself. The reversals, the way she makes things appear in a certain light and then totally reverses that, that's all done expertly. The motive, which Laura Thompson said is ludicrous. It was so powerful to me that this person would do what they did. It lifts the whole thing out of the whole dying rich guy, greedy heir thing into something else. What I started to understand when I was rereading it, which I have done many times, was that it's also an incredibly evocative picture of post-war England, when the mansions that we had all visited through all these mysteries to watch families get together and kill each other off were dying, when they were being sold off for pensions and schools and no one could afford the taxes anymore. One of the most heartrending characters in that book is the butler, who realizes that his time is done, that no matter who gets the house or who gets the money or whatever's going to happen, it's not going to be like that anymore. That the motive is connected to the war, that the elderly relatives fighting with the younger relatives, the sense of traditions being lost, that Christie is kind of transitioning herself into the modern age. Everything about that book, and just damn good mystery. I love it.
I made a fatal error, and I wrote about this in my blog post on After the Funeral, which wasn't that long ago in the last year, because I've read it that recently, of thinking of maybe I've read all the best Christies, or maybe I sort of know what she's about now, and then was blindsided. Absolutely.
Isn't that delicious to be blindsided by
her? It is. And you just think, this is a level of maturity in mystery writing and in any fiction writing that is... You know, when it's one of those books you think, oh, maybe I could have done better than that, or I've had ideas around that or something. When you read that book, you're like, how did you even make these links come together? And on top of that, I'll dive in with my favourite Christie, my Desert Island Christie.
There you go.
And it's my Desert Island Christie because I've read it so many times, and it might, I don't know if it surprised you, but it's Murder in the Mews. I just absolutely love Murder in the Mews. And the reason why is because it epitomises so much what I think Christie's good at for me, which is minimal, tight cast, absolutely focused one or two locations, one or two rooms. And obviously it's just a novella, but just what she does in that small space of time through, there's a little cupboard under the stairs with a few objects in it that are so frustrating because they're noticed by different people and you don't know why they're looking at them. And the attaché case, for example, and just the use of an object like that, and the relationships. It's almost a locked room, but not quite. And the way the rooms are used, it's just so, and as an artist myself, it's so sculptural because the rooms are so closely put together, but so many things is happening in each one. So that's quite specific for me, but I've always been beguiled by Murder on the Mews.
Wow.
In the Mews, sorry.
Barbara Plenderleith, something like that.
Yeah. It has that lovely start of the fireworks display. Mm. And Poirot saying, wouldn't this be the perfect night for a murder because the sounds are covering up the murder, and then of course it takes place. And just that she can have someone say one line like that, and that's the whole tension set. Yeah.
So we were talking last time when you weren't here about some of the brilliant things she does. A line like that. You have the fireworks, you have that drama, you have Poirot say a perfect night for a murder, which sends the reader off in a direction, which is why she is so brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
In any mystery you're going to have. Wow, the night is so scary. Someone could die tonight. And you're like, yep, that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So that's where we go. It's like, it is a perfect night for a murder. It's an Agatha Christie book. There's going to be a murder and then the dead body. And we are hooked into something that, you know, I'm not going to get into, but it's just brilliant that she uses what might be considered a standard line or a stereotypical beginning to weave you into her trap.
And the fact that it's called Murder in the Mews, I mean, it's so much about the site as well, which is what
I asked him the other day. I asked Jim, and we were walking around London, and I said, is that a muse?
Yeah.
He said, I don't know.
Well, you've been staying in Kensington, so yeah, they're all over the place.
They are, aren't they? You walk in, there's this kind of dead-end thing full of little like stables and houses.
Yeah, and it captures that as well, which is so awesome.
Mine would probably be The Moving Finger.
Ooh.
Because I really love that book.
Mm.
And I think what I love about it is, prior to reading it, I could think of very little less harmless than somebody writing a couple of nasty letters. Like, in an age when you have chemical warfare, where you have, you know, the possibility to kill thousands of people, to have nuclear fallout from nuclear bombs and the various things, when you have all of the gamut of violence of society that is possible to unfortunately experience all too easily, the idea of somebody writing a nasty letter, there is no threat behind that at all. And what The Moving Finger does beautifully is it takes the poison pen letter, the village setting, and it works together so incredibly to show how the damage just seeps in and seeps in and seeps in, and there's yet more doubt every single time a letter turns up, every single time something is said. You get these people who are new to the village who suddenly become the focus of it. And the way, the very insidious way that it just inserts itself into everything. It's a beautifully measured piece of work. It has one flaw, in that Aunt Jane has to turn up with about 6 pages to go in order to solve the bloody thing. And that frustrates me a tiny bit. But I think I could just read that book again and again and again because of how gorgeously it paints that picture of that community, and then how gorgeously it starts to pick it apart with this thing which isn't in any real sense a threat. And she has this brilliant ability to take something very everyday like a letter and make it this astonishingly risky and threatening element of a story. It also has, with the delivery of, I think it's the final letter, one of the best moments of how the guilty party is caught. There is that wonderful observation that is made that catches the guilty party, which I remember just really rocking me back on my heels. I think because so many murder mysteries are about what somebody does and what somebody sees, and this is about what somebody doesn't do, or about what somebody doesn't see, or about an action that doesn't occur, and that idea of an absence of something being at the heart of all of it and finally unpicking the skein, that still resonates really strongly with me.
Can I argue with you for a moment about your nitpick?
Go for it.
It's one of my favorite books.
Sure.
For all the reasons you say, the evocation of that village, those characters, they're so interesting. There's time taken to show them interacting with each other, to learn their histories, to learn about Miss Barton, why she has to do what she has to do. And there's this kind of lovely way that the Burtons are brought into this group. They feel like outsiders and slowly make their way in.
Yeah.
And everyone complains about Jane Market. It's just, it's a standard part of the contract, right? And she comes in so late, why does they even need her? Yeah. So let me tell you why they need her, okay? Because let's face it, the concept of the anonymous letter is a very standard village mystery trope. You've written about several of them. The Max Murray book.
Oh, Voice of the Court.
Yeah, which I bought and haven't read yet. Oh, and then when I went and found it, I found another one by someone else. Just the concept of those those anonymous letters are really intriguing. Dorothy Sayers' most famous book is all about anonymous letters. So this concept of people ripping into your private life is something that people walk in and say. So when it starts to happen in this village, the reader embraces that and just moves along with it. But Miss Marple, who is, this is like her fourth appearance, we know from Miss Marple, one of the things she can do is she understands villages. She understands the dirt, the scum on the pond. She understands the truth about the mundane evil of a village.
Yeah.
It's Miss Marple who has to come in to this situation, which she probably is familiar with, and see what's wrong with it. And without her eye, her outside eye, because Jerry and Joanna Burton don't understand villages and they don't understand letters. They can't do that. They can protect Megan, or they can do, they, you know, they can care. But Miss Marple understands this, and she sees what's wrong with it, because there is something very wrong with the situation. And because of that, she comes up with the truth.
I liked the idea, though, that the Burtons, because they are external to villages, because they weren't intrinsically a part of the village before, that they were therefore coming in with the outsider's perspective, not necessarily an understanding of villages per se. And you're absolutely right, that is exactly what the majority of the Marple books are predicated on. It's her innate understanding of the fundamental perversity of the human mind through observing it so close up in these small settings. But I guess there was a bit of me, and I need to reread it because I have only read it once, but there was a bit of me that felt, because the Burtons are the external ones, they should be the ones who, outside of it, should be able to look at it and go, that's the bit that doesn't fit. That's the rot. That's the problem. But I suppose there is that element of Miss Marple, I can understand it, that she is both external and also a part of just villages generally. So she can walk into any village, probably anywhere, and go, you're the one who's poisoning the well. You're the one who's stealing the chickens. You're the one who is stealing the postman's bike three times a week. Like, there's an element of her that she just understands that sort of small, compact living.
Yeah, I think we would all expect Jerry to be the detective.
Yeah.
But the relationship that Miss Marple has with Jerry is very funny.
Yes.
You know, she's like, dear boy, I know you're going to help me somehow. And ultimately she says, you did. You gave me a piece of information that really pointed me in the right direction. Almost throwing him a bone.
Yeah.
Because he isn't really, he's not dumb, but he does not understand.
No.
And he can't solve this. So together, you know, he's her muscle man.
Mm.
And it's fun.
He reminds me very much of, is it Luke Fitzwilliam?
Yes. Yes. In a book that I like, but is inferior to.
Yeah. But it's still that same principle.
Yes.
The outsider coming into the village. For some reason, I always get those two very mashed together in my head when I think of it.
And Luke doesn't solve it either.
Nope.
Having only read A Moving Finger once, and also having only read Endless Night once, to me there's a little bit of a link there. Maybe Endless Night is almost, although it doesn't contain the poison pen letters, but it has the new people in the village being absorbed into a strange tension. But there isn't a Marple. And of course the way that ends is as horrific as anyone can imagine. That's almost like the... It feels to me that's almost like what the village mystery without Marple coming in the end has to eventually go to. You know?
You understand it was a Marple. Endless Night is based on a Miss Marple short story, The Case of the Caretaker.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes.
Right.
It epitomizes everything you just said. Small village, newcomers, they're being menaced by this strange gypsy woman.
Mm-hmm.
What is going on? Miss Marple clears it up. Now, It's an odd story in that it doesn't evidently really happen. It's supposedly a story that her doctor is writing to kind of cheer her up because she's recovering from pneumonia. So he's writing a village tale. But then I think ultimately it's revealed that it's kind of based on real people. But yeah, everything about it is Miss Marple. The terrifying thing is that when they did that awful new Marple series, they did Endless Night as a Miss Marple story.
Gosh.
So it was the Endless Night tale with Miss Marple incongruously befriending Michael Rogers. It was the strangest thing. And none of it made sense. And then feeling awful at the end when she has to, you know, blow up these people's lives and reveal the killer.
Because that particular friendship seems especially unlikely to me.
Absolutely.
I mean, totally. Especially unlikely.
Yes. Yes, because Miss Marple would read this person immediately and say, here's what you need to do. Don't marry this girl. Do these things. And I think you have a shot at being happier.
Yeah. So maybe as a way of rounding up, I want to come to part of a question that you asked earlier, Brad, that we didn't quite get onto, but I thought was really interesting, which was, what do you come to Agatha Christie for? And maybe I could contextualize it by saying, you know, we've looked at our beginnings with Agatha Christie, particularly for you both reading it, and for you particularly, Brad, at a young, much younger age. When you come back to her now, even if you reread, what is it you come to her for?
I'm still amazed by her structure. The advantage, perhaps, of reading her when I was very young was that she fooled me most of the time. And when she didn't fool me, it was usually the books that most people conceive of as not very good, or her weaker book, like Dumb Witness, that Mirror Clue. But there are some books that I will reread. It's like watching an old favorite movie, you know, oh, here's the part where they're all, the Munchkins are all singing la 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 like they don't know, and then the whole smoke comes up and there's the witch. Maybe this time she'll step on a Munchkin, but you just love those moments. So I always talk about Death Comes as the End, Ancient Egypt, Death of Satipi. She's walking with her husband Yamos, and she's walking ahead on this cliff, the same cliff where Renesen the concubine died. And she looks behind her, and she looks over her husband's shoulder and goes, ah! And she falls. And that's when they all start to realize that the ghost of Renesen has come to destroy the family in vengeance for her death. But that's not what it is at all. And I know that, and I get chills every time I read that. So reading those moments and realizing what she's doing, that's one thing. The other thing is just how much I am now learning about the history of England from the 20s through the 50s into the 60s. But by then, I think it was a little bit shakier. But the whole post-war thing, one of my favorite books is Murder is Announced. And I read that for the mystery before and the characters. And now I have that, but and all the wonderful clues that are in there. And some of them are so subtle and so brilliantly. Like, you like don't even know they're clues. But now it's also about Miss Marple bringing in what happened to villages after the war. And I start to see that. And then seeing that jump across, because it happens a lot with the late Marples. The mirror cracked from side to side. It opens with her walking through the village and thinking, it's not my village anymore in that way.
I love that.
Finding the new housing developments with these pretty cheap houses close together and thinking, you know, and then her awful, awful companion that she can't stand, and how lucky she feels to find a young modern maid who in some ways resembles a smarter, newer version of the maid she loved before. I mean, it's just like, those senses of time passing and what it must have been like, what Christie is pouring of herself probably into these characters. Miss Marple, I've come to understand, reflects so much more of who Christie was and what she believed in and felt than, say, Mrs. Oliver, who's such a funny pastiche of a mystery writer, and we all say, oh, that's Christie in a way. But no, Miss Marple, much more so.
I've been saying that for a number of years as I've been reading the Christies, particularly the Marples, and you look at the density of Marples in her later career. Like, I find it very hard to believe, as popular opinion has it, that Sleeping Murder was written during the Second World War. I do not believe that Sleeping Murder was written during the Second World War, because I think at the time, by the end of the Second World War, she's written 2-3, I think, Marples. And then a lot of them come, majority of them come in relatively short order as she gets older and as she ages as a woman and as she sees her response to society around her as an elderly woman whose use is largely seen as having departed her, and which is something which is obviously brought out through the Tommy and Tuppence books as well. But Marple, there is so much Christian Marple. And I did various reviews I've written. I've said this and some people disdain it, and that's absolutely fine. This is the lovely thing about the subjectivity of reading. But I completely agree. I do love the sense of Miss Marple being Christie's way of dealing with how she is seeing the world. I mean, that's very much something I get out of reading it. Like, there's fundamentally a talk, isn't there, of whether a character, whether an author has a static central character or an evolving central character. So whether it is, we have over the course of this week, we have talked about the Viscount Linley books of Elizabeth George and the various changes that he goes through throughout that series, being very much an evolving character, or Poirot and Marple, who are essentially static. I mean, Poirot starts off already in Roger Ackroyd, he's already old enough that he's dyeing his hair and talking about retirement. And Murder on the Orient Express, I'm sure he talked about dyeing his moustaches. And I know Hastings gives him jip at some point.
He's pretty static. I'm not sure Marple is as static, but he is.
No, but I think like both of the characters, relatively speaking, when we compare them to modern crime writing, are relatively static characters.
Sure.
What evolves is the context in which Christie puts them. Because as much as she, and we said this last week, as much as she doesn't always write brilliantly about the contemporaneous settings, there is nevertheless a sense of what is changing around them. And even when you get Poirot sat in a weird kind of greasy spoon cafe in the 1960s in Third Girl, that feels weird and that feels wrong, because he is very much that older static character who belongs to a much earlier age. And actually, I'm loving seeing the world kind of evolving and emerging around them as they remain more or less steadfastly fixed in how they were. They get a bit older, they have the frustrations of friends dying, but it's the way the village changes, the way the attitudes change, the way the access to celebrities obviously becomes a very key part of like the mirror crack from side to side. The way in which Mr. Raphael becomes this wonderful character over the course of Caribbean Mystery and then into Nemesis. You know, turns in, starts off as this really crotchety old bastard, mm-hmm. and becomes, certainly by the end of Caribbean Mystery, just this phenomenal, beautiful, gorgeous character. Very much as part of the setting, very much as what he's seen change over the course of his life, and then obviously how he goes to play into that later book. I think now, as I've got into this later tranche of her work, where the plots are undoubtedly declining in quality, that's very much something that has kept me, you know, not just reading them because I've read 77, so I might as well read 80, but reading them because I am very genuinely interested to see the world around them and how Christie presents it.
I think for me, the reason I come to Christie, or at least the feeling I feel I get when coming to Christie, is that I always get a bit of a chill. I get excited when I think, okay, maybe I should read a Christie next. You know, you've got other things lined up. You maybe have an idea about things you want to try, you're not sure. But when I know I'm going to read a Christie next, I'm like, I know I'm going to be plunged into one sentence descriptors of characters, like she had a sharp brown bob and a catty face. And that's it. They're never described again. But you're like, oh, that's just all you need. And then you're so submerged in that character. And then in the settings, the same with everything else. And I know I'm just going to be held. I'm going to be swept in by that, and I get excited to approach her writing and see what she's going to do. It's just going to be beautifully written. I don't want to say it's like putting on a nice jumper or slippers and relaxing, because I don't think that's what it is at all. It's more that it's just, you know, you're just going to come to that maturity, and it's just great artistry, isn't it? Great handling of fiction and language, and I'm always so excited to come to her for that reason.
So, no impossibilities this week. Nevertheless, it's always lovely to sit and talk about Christie with anyone. It's particularly lovely to sit and talk about Christie with Brad. It's been absolutely amazing to have you here, man. Thank you so much for making the trip.
I am so excited to have this opportunity to talk face to face to face. That is really exciting. And I do want to say thank you for taking a little bit of a break from Impossible Crimes, but I do want to remind you that all these incredible authors that we all go back and forth about on our blogs, when we have these daily conversations about these incredible people, some of whom have been around forever and are just being rediscovered, a lot of the reason we read them is because of those experiences with people like Christie. Mm. And if Christie didn't get us started, I cannot imagine a well-read, well-rounded mystery reader who doesn't at some point turn to her and include her as part of their experience. But thanks. This has been so much fun with you guys.
Yeah, it's been great.
An absolute joy. As always, listeners, thanks for tuning in. You can find my blog at The Reader Is Warned.
You can find mine at the place that you're currently listening to this to, so you've presumably already found it.
And I am at Ah Sweet Mystery.
And we'll see you next time.
Yeah, see you soon.
Bye.